Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Tuesday, May 23, 2023. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, families, colon, shooting lacked investigation. This story by Trish Mahaffey. And the story includes photos of Nicole Owen's stepmother, Nicole Winters, as she gives a victim impact statement during a sentencing hearing Monday for Timothy L. Rush at the Linn County Courthouse in Cedar Rapids. Rush, age 33, was originally charged with two counts of second-degree murder for the April 2022 fatal shootings of Nicole Owens and Marvin Cox, but pleaded to two counts of involuntary manslaughter, five counts of reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury, and one count each of intimidation with a dangerous weapon and possession of a firearm by a felon. Photo also includes Timothy L. Rush as he looks on Monday during a sentencing hearing at the Linn County Courthouse. Rush, age 33, was sentenced to 30 years in prison for the fatal shootings. Nicole Winters feels anger, frustration, and confusion about losing her stepdaughter, Nicole, who was fatally shot by Timothy Rush in April 2022 outside the Taboo nightclub and lounge, and also about the lack of investigation and the systemic issues that affect people who look like me, people of color, she said. Winters said Monday in a victim impact statement at Rush's sentencing, "There was a lack of care and compassion throughout this case for her and her family. Three of Owens's sisters were at the club that night. She said one sister, Stacia Winters, was choked by Rush, but no one questioned her or the others. The stepmother said she's a Christian and has to forgive, but God will judge Rush and those who fell short in the investigation of her stepdaughter's slaying. Nicole's life did matter," Nicole Winters said. "Two families are hanging in the balance. We now only have memories of Nicole and Marvin Cox. Pray you are never on this side and sit here wanting justice. There would have been a trial if she wasn't like me, a black person." Justine Grant, mother of Cox's six-year-old daughter, said she didn't know what to tell her child when she received the call saying Cox had been shot. "Pain is an understatement," Grant said. She and her daughter, along with Cox's other family members, watched him fight for his life for 3 months before he died July 24, 2022. Each day they would live in fear of his death. When they were told he died, she knew there would be no more "see you later, alligators," like he told his daughter, no more hugs and kisses. Grant didn't think Rush's sentence of 30 years was fair. His life and Owens's life meant more, she said. Others in Owens' family and Cox's family also said they were let down by the system because of the plea deal Rush received for fatally shooting Owens and Cox, both of Cedar Rapids. Rush, 33, originally charged with two counts of second-degree murder, pleaded to lesser charges in March before his trial was to start the next week. He pleaded to two counts of involuntary manslaughter, five counts of reckless use of a firearm causing bodily injury, and one count each of intimidation with a dangerous weapon and possession of a firearm by a felon. The criminal complaint states that Rush fired intentionally and indiscriminately with what police believe was a 9mm handgun into the large crowd at the club. A surveillance video captured the shooting and also showed Rush running out of the club after he stopped firing. According to the complaint and plea, Rush also shot Alazia Cotton and Michaela Stokes, causing them serious injuries, and Trainice Worley, Denise Triplett, and Richard Nixian, who suffered bodily injuries. Sixth District Judge Sean McPartland sentenced Rush to 30 years, running three charges concurrently and all others consecutively. He also was ordered to pay $150,000 each in restitution to the heirs or estates of Owens and Cox. Rush has no mandatory minimum to serve, and he will receive credit for good time. Also, as part of the plea agreement, federal prosecutors will not file charges regarding Rush illegally using a firearm because he is a felon, Rush's attorney Lindsay Garner said during the sentencing. Rush, who was crying before the hearing started, apologized to the families of Owens and Cox, saying he never intended to hurt anybody. He said he couldn't move on from this or make it up to anybody. Owens's other family members said they didn't believe Rush was sincere. They talked about his jealousy of Owens. Some of them said it was no coincidence that only she and Cox were fatally shot because Cox was interested in dating Owens. Eugene Winters Jr., Owens's brother, said Nicole was the light of their family and always brought them together. He called Rush's apology fake. "What type of man are you?" the brother asked. "I don't know." Deja Winters, sister of Owens, said her family is broken by this horrendous act. It never crossed their minds that Rush was the shooter at the time. She told Rush he let down Nicole Owens and the daughter of Rush and Owens, and the daughter Rush and Owens had together. Owens lit up the room with her infectious smile, Winters said. Their memories of her will live on, but their heartbreak will never go away. Stacia Winters, who was emotional during her statement, said she was at Taboo that night and witnessed her sister's death. The trauma broke her and left her with hatred. She has flashbacks of hearing the gunshots and seeing Owens's blood and her shaking and trembling and fighting for her life. Stacia said Rush choked her after shooting her sister and then attempted to blame her for Owens's death. Stacia said Owens wanted to leave Rush and he was jealous of Cox, who was interested in her sister. She told Rush he disgusted her and called him a murderer. Marie Mulkey, Cox's mother, said getting the call that her son had been shot in the head was unbelievable to her. His death has caused deep and permanent pain for his children and their family, including his twin brother, who didn't give a statement but was in the courtroom Monday. 30 years feels like a slap on the wrist, Mulkey said. Marvin and Nicole didn't deserve this. Eugene Winters Sr., Owens' father, said, "You took my baby from me," and he started to cry. "You lied and lied. I hate you. I hate you so much." Winters Sr. also said his daughter had wanted out of the relationship with Rush, and he knew that's why Rush killed her. Blasia McDowell, mother of Cox's 10 and 12-year-old sons, said her boys were confused and heartbroken. They told her what they missed most about their father was just spending time with him. Sarah James, mother of three of Cox's children, in her statement read by a survivor's program advocate, said she was 5 months pregnant when Cox was shot. Her child was traumatized in the womb and will be traumatized for the rest of her life. Dimeon Walker, 29, another man charged for a separate shooting that night in the club, was convicted of first-degree murder in the fatal shooting of Michael Valentine. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Also on the front page of the Gazette today, this Isabella Zaluska story, "The county is ready to start on government campus remake." The first phases of the Johnson County administrative campus renovation are likely going to be bid in early June, with construction anticipated to start in August, after months of review, redesign, and discussions of how to keep costs down. The $10.2 million initial project includes renovating the Health and Human Services Building and the County Administration Building, which are located along South Dubuque Street in Iowa City. The campus renovation has been in discussion since 2017. It originally was estimated at $15 million, but the cost increased to $27.9 million after a redesign that added scope. In January, the Board of Supervisors indicated support for moving forward with the project, but in phases. Supervisors plan to use county reserves and federal pandemic aid to pay for the project. The $10.2 million cost covers the first two phases of the project. Supervisors have not yet talked about how much the board is willing to spend on the overall project cost. The board also heard updates from OPN Architects, with the most recent update presented at last week's work session. It included the updated cost for Phase 1 and 2, which includes the Administration Building and County Health and Human Services Level 3. "This is really a transformational moment," said Justin Bishop, a principal at OPN Architects. The before and after photos will be dramatic, but I think the lasting impact on perhaps the culture and the people in the space is pretty exciting too. The board set a public hearing at last week's formal meeting for June 1 on the proposed plans, specifications, contract, and estimated cost for the remodel project. If approved by the board next week, the $10.2 million project will go out to bid June 6 with a deadline of July 11. The supervisors will review bids during their work session July 19, and construction is anticipated to start August 1. We have looked at this multiple times and from various angles. Supervisor Lisa Green Douglas said last week, "I think that we're at this critical point that we need to move forward." County officials and staff have said the project is necessary to improve safety, experience, customer service, and accessibility for county employees and the public. The guiding principles of the project have been safety, wellness, equality, human experience, and functionality. This includes allowing for remote work, having a sustainable design, adding accessibility, increasing customer service, and ensuring long-term adaptability, among other priorities. James Bechtel, project and systems analyst for the county, said last week the update is a culmination of a lot of review and a milestone before staff begin to prepare the bid package. "We've been deep in the details," Bishop added. The construction cost of $10.2 million includes its current scope, furniture, site work, and contingency. Before the May update, the last time the board heard from OPN architects and staff was March 22, Bechtel said, when supervisors heard about cost reduction strategies. Staying on schedule for construction will be critical to ensure that the auditor's office, which is in the administration building, is ready to go ahead with overseeing the 2024 general election, said Zach Ryder, an architect at OPN Architects. Turning to page 2 on the Iowa Today page, this story by Emily Anderson: Cedar Rapids father and athlete drowns while swimming in West Okoboji Lake. A Cedar Rapids man drowned Saturday in West Okoboji despite attempts to rescue him from the chilly waters, according to police and family. Alexander Glover, 21, was visiting the Spirit Lake area with his girlfriend's family, said his mother, Sandra Williams. While boating on the lake, he had jumped out of the boat to swim for a while. The boat drifted away and he attempted to swim back, but he got tired and slipped under the water, according to a news release from the Dickinson County Sheriff's Office. The temperature in the lake at the time was 57 degrees, which the National Center for Cold Water Safety classifies as very dangerous, immediately life-threatening for swimmers. The water was about 13 feet deep where Glover went under. The family tried to throw Glover a rope, but he wasn't able to reach it. Someone called 911 at 1:26 p.m. to report that Glover was drowning. A kayaker, Charles Anderegg, dove from his kayak and brought Glover to the surface, where members of the family Glover was staying with gave him CPR until the Arnold's Park Okoboji Fire and Rescue Team arrived by boat. The team transported Glover to shore. He was taken to Lakes Regional Health Care, where he died. "I got the call just before they took off with him on the emergency boat with the paramedics and the EMS. I greatly appreciate all efforts," Williams said. "We drove 4 hours up to Spirit Lake. It was the longest 4 hours and 22 minutes of my life. The staff was very nice there. They were very caring. Nobody left his side." Williams had heard from her son earlier that day when he texted her pictures of his cat Pluto, who Williams said he brought everywhere, including on the trip. Glover had a 1-year-old daughter with his girlfriend, and his girlfriend is pregnant with Glover's second child. He also was a devoted uncle to his niece. He had recently started working at HTH Companies, a construction services company, according to Williams. Glover graduated from Washington High School in 2020, but spent part of his senior year in Waterloo playing football for Waterloo East. He also was always into sports, playing football, soccer, and baseball at school and in the community, his mom said. He grew up in the junior leagues, being a quarterback and a leader. In soccer, he was the fast kid that had the wheels and always wore two different shoes. His coaches hated that, but he did what he was supposed to do, Williams said. He lit up the room because you either heard him talking and laughed with him or laughed at him. It was one or the other. There was no in between. He was a ball of fire. Glover had a group of friends who knew they could count on him, his mother said. He was close friends with Andrew Gaston, a teen who was shot and killed in 2020 in Cedar Rapids, and helped and supported his friends as they dealt with his death, Williams said. His biggest impact is he was a friend with unconditional boundaries. He found that having friends and taking friends as they are and valuing them every day was more important than holding a grudge, she said. The family started a GoFundMe page hoping to raise $15,000 to help transport Glover home and to pay for a funeral service. As of Monday afternoon, that goal had been met and exceeded by almost $500. Williams said the community has been incredibly supportive since Glover's death. She said she woke up to 35 messages Monday on her phone from people expressing condolences, some of them from people she didn't even know. His impact on our community and doing what he did as a student athlete, they did community service. It will never be forgotten, Williams said. From Iowa City, this story by Aaron Jordan, Iowa City's Terry Trueblood off limits for swimming. Swimming is off limits, at least for now, at Terry Trueblood Recreation Area in Iowa City because of high bacteria levels in the lake. Iowa City's regular water tests of Sand Lake, the centerpiece of Terry Trueblood Park, showed E. coli levels above safe standards for swimming, according to a news release on Monday. It's the second year in a row bacteria has closed the lake for swimming. In 2022, the no-swim advisory lasted for weeks, starting in mid-June. Staff at that time said they did not remember another summer in which the lake's bacteria count triggered a warning. Sand Lake is a popular spot for kayak and paddleboard rental, which may continue at the user's discretion. E. coli is an indicator of fecal material that can carry parasites or other pathogens that sickens swimmers. It can come from geese, humans, or agricultural runoff. The bacteria standard for safe recreational waters in Iowa is based on two components, a one-time maximum standard based on a single sample, or a geometric mean of five samples in a 30-day period. The swim advisory will be in effect until the conditions improve. You can check for updates online at icgov.org/parks-and-trails. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial printed today is a reprint from Monday's New York Daily News, and the title, Going the Ron, that's R-O-N, Ron Way in Florida. Ron DeSantis doesn't just want to run for the presidency. The Florida governor seems to already have declared himself president as he tries to wrest clear federal responsibilities away from the U.S. government with a new Florida law that heavily penalizes employment of undocumented immigrants, gives state officials more authority to investigate potential immigration violations, and forces hospitals to collect immigration status, among other things. Almost 150 years ago, in 1875's Chi Lung v. Freeman, the Supreme Court established that regulating immigration was exclusively the domain of the national government, not states. That hasn't stopped plenty of states from trying it anyway. 13 years ago, Arizona set off the modern wave of immigration organizing in enacting the disastrous SB 1070, most of which was eventually struck down by the Supreme Court as a violation of the Supremacy Clause. More recently, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has taken it upon himself to appear tough on the border, sending National Guardsmen to an ill-fated and ultimately pointless deployment. almost setting off an international incident with Mexico over truck inspections, and, of course, busing migrants here and elsewhere without any coordination or notice. Apparently envious of the havoc Abbott was wreaking, DeSantis joined the clown show, using a shadowy former Army counterintelligence agent to trick migrants into boarding planes bound for Martha's Vineyard, paid for by a dedicated state fund that this law has now expanded. DeSantis seems wholly indifferent or apathetic to the fact that the consequences of his culture war are being suffered by his own state. Since the law was enacted, there have been reports of employees fearful of returning to work in a variety of industries and even attempting to arrange boycotts. The short-term effects still are uncertain, but it seems clear that in the long run, Florida will lose out on the contributions of an important population, just as it will face a brain drain from DeSantis's heavy-handed crackdown on academia and anti-business war with Disney. The governor doesn't care. His eyes are set northward to Washington. Also on the Insight page, this article in a guest column by Allie Wampler is titled, Iowa Attorney General Must Change Course. Last month, I learned of the pause on payments for emergency contraceptives and abortion for sexual assault survivors by the Iowa Attorney General's office. This leaves the burden of cost on the survivor of sexual assault, and in some cases eliminates emergency contraception or abortion as an option for unintended pregnancy and prevention. Sexual assault survivors deserve access to emergency contraception, access to accurate information, and access to abortion care if they choose. The financial burdens associated with outcomes of rape or sexual assault should never fall on a survivor. I urge the Attorney General to resume payments as soon as possible. I am a sexual assault survivor, a sexual assault response nurse, and a nurse practitioner who sees survivors for follow-up care. Survivors deserve better than this. Emergency contraception is a safe option to prevent pregnancy after an assault. Should it fail, the option for abortion should be available for sexual assault survivors. Abortion is extremely safe and effective, also expensive. The burden of costs for abortion care should not be left to the survivor. According to the World Health Organization, limiting access to abortion or emergency contraception is a violation of a person's reproductive rights. WHO 2021. Every person should have the option to choose not to be pregnant or to prevent pregnancy regardless of financial status, location, or background. There are many falsehoods circulating that emergency contraception causes abortion. Emergency contraception is not an abortion pill. Per the Attorney General's own website, quote, Plan B, it does not cause an abortion if you are already pregnant. It simply helps prevent pregnancy before it starts, by temporarily delaying the release of an egg from the ovary, so there's no egg to meet the sperm, end quote. This is supported by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology as well. These medications do not cause abortion. These medications delay ovulation. Plan B does not cause harm to an existing pregnancy. According to the World Health Organization, emergency contraception is safe and effective. The International Association of Forensic Nurses recommends emergency contraception be immediately offered and available to all with the ability to become pregnant to prevent unintended pregnancy after sexual assault. There already are numerous barriers to accessing emergency contraception, such as cost, location, access to pharmacies, and transportation in a timely manner. Ensuring sexual assault victims can access free emergency contraception at a forensic exam following assault eliminates these barriers. There is substantial trauma that can result from sexual assault. Requiring survivors to cover costs for a consequence of the actions of others is cruel and traumatic. As a survivor and a person who works closely with survivors, I find this abhorrent. There already are numerous hoops survivors must jump through, including a forensic exam, disclosing their story, reliving the experience and the assault itself, denying the ability to prevent or end unintended pregnancy will only increase poor outcomes in survivors and compound an already very traumatic experience. I urge the Attorney General to reinstate payments for emergency contraception and abortion care for sexual assault survivors. I urge the public to speak out on behalf of survivors and advocate for their access to care. Sexual assault is never the fault of the survivor, and the state should uphold its previous policy to cover the costs and support survivors. That article today is submitted by Allie Wampler, DNP, ARNP, WHNP, SANE-A. She is a women's health nurse practitioner, certified sexual assault nurse examiner, and abortion nurse in Iowa City. And we have one community letter today. Kelowna Library Board takes bold stand. I'm writing to express my thanks and gratitude to the Kelowna Public Library Board of Trustees for voting to keep the book Gender Queer on the library shelves. In doing so, they have defended the right to read in their community. And if the reporting in this article is accurate, I also extend thanks and gratitude to the Kelowna community members who spoke at the meeting for the mature tone of the discussion. The kind of bullying and threats we see so often in meetings like this does not seem to have been present. Keeping this book in the library collection was the right call. No one's rights have been violated, and the rights of the community to information have been affirmed. Nor is it an endorsement of the ideas contained in the book. The library's job is to provide an inclusive collection so you and I can read and make up our own minds, which is a democracy-supporting exercise. Censorship shortcuts the free exchange of ideas and is destructive to democracy. While some might see the library board's vote as simply doing its job, these days doing so counts as a courageous act. And that's signed today by Brian Davis from Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette today on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Turning now to the obituary page, we start with the short notices. From Cedar Rapids, there are several notices. William H. Shika, 93, died Sunday, May 21st. Papich Kuba Funeral Service, Cedar Rapids. Also, Jerome Smith, 66, died Monday, May 22nd. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, Cedar Rapids. And Willie James West, 76, died Sunday, May 21st. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, Cedar Rapids. In Olmine, Terry W. Woodstock Jackson, 65, died Thursday, May 18. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home, Olmine. In Waukon, Harold, known as Ike F. Kolsch, 92, died Sunday, May 21st. Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. And in one other death, Thomas George Wolcott, age 69, of La Crosse, Wisconsin, died Monday, May 15. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home of Prairie du Chien is assisting the family. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Cedar Rapids, Mark W. Daniel, age 60, passed away Friday, May 19th. There will be a celebration of life at 11 a.m. June 4th at 53 Miller Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids in the community room. Mark helped many people in his life and did everything he could when he could. He was loved by everyone and will be missed. Also in Cedar Rapids, Gerald David Frost, age 72, died from a stroke May 16th. He loved Harley-Davidson motorcycles and collected historical artifacts. He leaves behind his adult children, sibling, and friends. He will be greatly missed, especially by his sister Ramona, whom he lived with and she cared for him. In Cedar Rapids, Joe Sarai, 51, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Thursday, May 18th at the University of Iowa Hospital, with life-threatening injuries caused by a motorcycle accident. He was surrounded by his loving family, who mournfully said goodbye. Services will be at the Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Family will greet friends Tuesday, May 23 from 4 to 7 p.m., with the funeral service being held on Wednesday, May 24 at 1 p.m. Following the service will be Joe's last Wednesday night ride, which will end at Chrome Horse in Cedar Rapids for a celebration of life at 4 p.m. Join us in wearing Joe's dress code. Brosh Chapel is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to the Joe Sarai Memorial Fund, and online condolences left at broshchapel.com. From Cedar Rapids, Mary Darlene Cobes. A graveside service will be held for Mary at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday, May 23 at Oak Shade Cemetery. Special thanks to Hospice of Mercy for their assistance in caring for Mary during her last days. Please share your support and memories with her family on the tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. From Cedar Rapids, Stephen Thomas Stepanek, 37, died peacefully May 20th after an inspirational 8-month fight against glioblastoma, a grade 4 brain cancer. After cremation, a visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, May 25, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in southwest Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life service will take place at 4 p.m. Friday, May 26th at Bethany Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids, followed by a reception at Bass Farms in Mount Vernon at 6 p.m. Stephen's ashes will later be buried at the Czech National Cemetery. You can leave condolences online at murdochfuneralhome.com. In Cedar Rapids, Betty Ann Blecker Stoklasa, age 101, passed away at the Hiawatha Care Center Sunday, May 21st, surrounded by her loving family. A visitation will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories Tuesday, May 30th from 9 a.m. until service time at 10 a.m., with Pastor Jamie Glenn Burns officiating. Interment to follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of the Last Supper. Memorial contributions may be made in her name to a charity of your choice. The family would like to thank the entire staff at Hospice of Mercy, Dr. Ann Sonnen, and the staff at Hiawatha Care Center for all the love and support they showed Betty while she was in their care. From Cedar Rapids, Linda L. Schimberg. Our loving sister and aunt, Linda, age 78, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on May 18th at her home. Daughter of Gwendolyn A. and Charles C. Schimberg, Jr., Linda was born in Cedar Rapids on March 27th, 10 minutes after her twin sister, Carol, was born. A private family service will be held at All Saints Catholic Church, followed by a burial at Mount Calvary in Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to the Catherine McCauley Center, 1220 Fifth Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. From Iowa City, Mark Davis, age 59, passed away May 21st, surrounded by his family. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Thursday, May 25th at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. A service including military honors will follow at 1 p.m. For a complete obituary, please visit lansingfuneral.com. In Central City, Dennis H. Farrington, 78, passed away from a sudden illness at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids, May 20th. There will be a celebration of life from 1 to 4 p.m. June 18th at Woodpecker Lodge in Pinnacon Ridge Park in Central City. See you on the other side. Please share a memory of Dennis at murdochfuneralhome.com. From Walker, Iowa, Carl Eugene Zeller, age 84, passed away Wednesday, May 17th at his home in Walker. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, May 27th at the Reef Family Center in Independence, the Reverend Dr. Charles Clark officiating. Burial will be held at Troy Mills Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, May 26th at the Reef Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. To leave an online condolence, go to reeffamilycenter.com. From Norway, Vincent Harold Schulte, age 80, passed away Friday, May 19th at Colonial Manor Nursing Home, surrounded by his family. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 24th at St. Michael's Catholic Church Parish Center in Norway. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. Thursday, May 25th at St. Michael's Church. Burial to follow at St. Michael's Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family and online condolences left at newhousefuneralservice.com. From Fort Myers, Florida, Russell, known as Russ, Jerome Tibbetts, 73, longtime Cedar Rapids resident, passed away May 6th in Fort Myers, Florida. He was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Russ will be interred at Fort Snelling National Cemetery in Minneapolis. From Guttenberg, Elaine Catherine Hoffman, 92, passed away at her home surrounded by family on May 8. She was born March 19, 1931 in Greeley, Iowa. Arrangements are being handled by Morris Funeral Home, 207 South 1st Street in Guttenberg. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, May 25th at Morris Funeral Home in Guttenberg. Visitation will continue prior to the funeral mass from 9 to 9:45 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Guttenberg. A mass of Christian burial will commence at 10 a.m. Friday, May 26th at St. Mary's, with burial in the church cemetery. The Reverend Marvin Brees will officiate. The family asks that memorials be directed to St. Croix Hospice or Guttenberg Municipal Hospital. From Monticello, Agnes Dewitt, 86, passed away Saturday, May 20 at Unity Point Transitional Care Center with her family by her side. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 26th at Saints Peter and Paul Lutheran, rural Monticello, with interment in the Oakwood Cemetery. Pastor Holly Knaus officiated at the services. Friends may call from 4 to 7 Thursday at the Getch Funeral Home. By visiting GetchOnline.com, you can share your thoughts, memories, and condolences with Agnes's family and sign the online guest book. Memorials can be made to the Monticello Food Bank or to the church. From Iowa City, Earl, known as Murphy, age 99, died peacefully Thursday, May 18. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. with a time of remembrance to begin at 6 p.m. Thursday, June 1st at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Friday, June 2nd at St. Mary's Church, Father Stephen Witt officiating. Burial will be at St. Joseph's Cemetery, followed by a luncheon and celebration of Earl's life in the lower level of St. Mary's. Memorials are suggested to the Earl and Louise Murphy Athletic Scholarship in care of the Levitt Center for University Advancement, 1 West Park Road, Iowa City, or to Briarwood Health Care Center, 605 Greenwood Drive, also in Iowa City. In Iowa City, Norman, known as Norm F. Callis, age 99, died at Oak Knoll Retirement Residence in Iowa City, May 19. There will be a rosary at 4:30 p.m. Friday, May 25th at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service. Mass of Christian burial will be at 9 a.m. Saturday, May 27th at St. Mary's Catholic Church, with burial immediately following. A celebration of Norm's life will be held in the Hayden Room at Oak Knoll beginning at 2 p.m. May 27. Memorials are suggested to the University of Iowa Center of Advancement in care of the Norm F. Callis Excellence in Business Communications Scholarship Fund, or to the Oak Knoll Foundation Music Therapy Program. Online condolences can be left at lansingfuneral.com. In Marion, Dorothy, known as Dottie Lynn Kresnicka of Marion, passed peacefully at home Friday, May 19th, with loved ones by her side. Online condolences can be left at iowacremation.com under obituaries. In Marion, Donald K. Shippey, 59, formerly of Waterloo, died Saturday, May 20th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids after a lengthy battle with cancer. Memorial services will be at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, May 25th at Ascension Lutheran in Waterloo. Visitation for 1 hour prior to the services at the church. Burial will take place at Wadena Cemetery at a later date. Condolences can be left at lockfuneralservices.com. Lock at Tower Park is assisting the family. And lastly, from Marion, on Wednesday, May 17th, Betty M. Offerman, 78, passed away peacefully surrounded by family. Visitation will be held at 9:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 24th at St. Joseph's Catholic Church, with Mass and lunch to follow. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family with arrangements. Please share a memory of Betty at murdochfuneralhome.com. Turning now to the sports page, this high school notebook story, Rundquist is headed to Iowa City, Regina. Tabbed as the new boys basketball coach. It's not often you get a chance to hire a coach who has won a state championship. When Iowa City, Regina got that chance, it pounced. The school announced on Monday that Paul Rundquist will lead its boys basketball program. Rundquist replaces Barry Lehman and will be Regina's third head coach in 4 seasons and its 6th in 10 years. The Regals went 9-13 this past season. I am truly honored and excited to join Regina High School as the head boys varsity basketball coach, Rundquist said in a news release from the school. I believe in instilling discipline, hard work, and a sense of community in my players. Together we will strive for excellence on and off the court, building a program that inspires both personal and team growth. Rundquist won a Class 3A state championship in 2012 as head coach at Mount Pleasant. The Maquoketa Valley grad has 375 career victories in 24 seasons as head coach at Mediapolis, Mount Pleasant, and Iowa City West. He has been co-head coach with Steve Bergman at West for the past 5 seasons. This story by Jeff Johnson. And in high school baseball, big games loom this week. This story by KJ Pilcher. State track has concluded and some baseball programs will welcome back regulars who competed over the weekend. Here's a look ahead at some noteworthy matchups this week. Today, Dyersville Beckman is at Dubuque Wallert. Wednesday, Linmar is at Iowa City West. Thursday, Independence is at Solon. Also, Clear Creek Amana is at Benton Community. And Friday, Mid Prairie is at Williamsburg. In boys' state tennis, Charlie LeGrand has come a long way from hitting foam balls over a couch cushion as a 3-year-old. From those humble beginnings, a tennis career has blossomed and continues to grow. The Cedar Rapids Xavier freshman not only joined a team that lost a wealth of talent, including 2022 state champions Brady Horstman, Declan Cole, and Hugh Courtier, he had the task of stepping in to the number one single spot Horstman held his entire prep career. I was not positive that he was going to be the number one player, Xavier coach Jim Potts said of LeGrand. Plus, I knew that no one was going to come in and be able to replace Brady in the first year. Horstman closed his career last spring with a state singles title and helped the Saints to their 3rd straight team championship. Time will tell whether LeGrand can match Horstman's career achievements. LeGrand will be one of 16 players seeking the Class 1A singles title in the 2-day event to be held today and Wednesday at Burns Park in Waterloo. In sports of area interest today, boys golf state tournaments are happening at Vinker Memorial Course, that's the Class 3A, Coldwater Golf Links, 2A, and Ames Golf and Country Club, 1A. In boys tennis, again, it is state singles and doubles in Iowa City for Class 2A and in Waterloo for Class 1A. Girls regional soccer finals take place today. And in high school softball, Washington is at Kennedy, Jefferson at Prairie, Iowa City West is at Iowa City High, Xavier at Liberty, and Linmar at Waterloo West. Boys baseball finds Jefferson at Davenport North and Regina at Williamsburg. Turning to the Business 380 page, no blueprint for auction business. This story from Katie Mills Giorgio. Some business owners found that the shifts they had to do during the pandemic ended up transforming their business. Mark Sharpless, owner of Sharpless Auctions in Iowa City, is one of those. Before the pandemic, the auction house overlooking Interstate 80 just east of Iowa City held in-person auctions of pre-owned and estate goods every Wednesday evening since opening in 1988. These days, however, all the Sharpless auctions are held online. When the pandemic started, we couldn't have those live auctions because we couldn't gather people together, Sharpless said. So we went online. I'd say it's a pandemic success story, really. At first, we were pushed into this and we weren't sure how the transition was going to go. We do have people ask us, when are you going to go back to your live auctions? He said, but the way things are progressing, I don't think that's going to happen. All bids and payments at Sharpless Auctions are now handled virtually. Two online Friday auctions are held with pickups scheduled on Saturday. Two Sunday auctions have pickups on Monday. The auction items come in on consignment and are goods purchased by Sharpless, making the auctions a mix of new and used items. The online platform the company uses, Sharpless said, has made it go quite smoothly. People get online and look and see they can maybe get a deal, and then they get hooked, he said. Previously, you had to come here on a Wednesday evening and stand and wait for 2 hours to bid on something. Some people just couldn't come. So now you can bid from anywhere, on your phone, and come pick it up. That allows flexibility in your day. It has freed up customers and our own time. This is a whole different way to run the auction business. While the auctions themselves take place online, Sharpless is open during the week if bidders want to stop and look at the items being offered. Sharpless said he also does specialty auctions, including some estates, RVs, vehicles, and lawn and garden equipment. We sold 5 campers on Friday, he said. They were all bought for fair market value, and the winning bidders all picked them up in the time they were allotted, and we've got happy customers. At this time of year, we're doing truckloads of nursery stock, including trees and shrubs. Sharpless, age 57, said he does miss some of the interactions he had with customers during the live auctions, but I enjoy the freedom of this more, he said. There's a give and take with anything. This is just a lot smoother way of running auctions. It's easier for customers, too. People can bid from anywhere, and this isn't restricting their time either, Sharpless said. In any given week, about 70% of the bidders are returning customers. Our footprint has grown a lot bigger with online versus in-person, he said. The age demographics have shifted too. Most of those who came to the live auctions tended to be the over 50 crowd. With online bidding, the business is seeing more young bidders, which is a welcome shift. The auction business, he added, stays pretty consistent throughout the year, with things picking up slightly in the spring. A team of 20 to 25 people are required to turn over the auction inventory every week. It's a unique business. There's no blueprint to it, Sharpless said. We are learning as we go, and sometimes we don't know what we might be auctioning next. And sometimes, he added with a laugh, I do wonder myself where it all goes. And in brief, if you go, it's Sharpless Auctions, 5049 Herbert Hoover Highway Northeast in Iowa City. The phone number there is 319-351-8888. Online, sharplessauctions.com. Turning to the community page, I'll have to abbreviate this story by Emily Anderson, Johnson County nonprofit to open Iowa City Reentry House. Inside Out, a Johnson County nonprofit organization that supports people returning to society after being incarcerated, will be opening a reentry house in Iowa City for low-income, formerly incarcerated men. The house at 719 Page Street was recently purchased and will be home to up to 6 men at a time. Residents will be able to stay in the house for up to 2 years, and Inside Out staff will be available to help them find jobs, community resources, and new housing when the time comes. The rent will be $500 a month and will include all utilities. There are a lot of folks that are trying to get out of prison, but they don't have a place to go. Michelle Hines, executive director of Inside Out, said, "We've seen it over and over again, folks getting out and just not being able to find a place to live. And if you can't find a roof over your head, then everything else kind of tumbles around you." After some remodeling and construction, which is ongoing, the house will have 6 bedrooms, a large living room and kitchen, and other communal spaces. Hines said the nonprofit wanted to make sure each resident has their own bedroom so they can have privacy they weren't often given while incarcerated, but also a communal space where they can socialize and support each other. Qualified applicants will be chosen on a first-come, first-served basis and others placed on a waiting list in case they're still qualified and looking for housing when another room becomes available. Inside Out hopes to eventually work on purchasing additional reentry homes, including one for women. There's no other barrier as large as finding housing in this community. There just really isn't. So be able to give folks a head start. It's really important. And this Eastern Iowa brief, Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center will host its 18th annual garden party, Growing Our Roots, from 4:30 to 8 on June 10 at its grounds, 120 East Boyson Road in Hiawatha. The fundraiser will include a night of live music, food, and nature. All proceeds from the event will go toward supporting and expanding Prairie Woods' outdoor spaces, including its gardens that produce thousands of pounds of fresh organic produce each year. Once harvested, the produce is donated to a local food pantry that serves those facing food insecurity in the community. This year's party includes a tapas-style buffet dinner, wine, beer, and non-alcoholic beverages, a silent auction with unique experiences, and handcrafted items. Live music will be by native flute player Johnny Lipford. The cost is $60. To register, visit prairiewoods.org/garden-party. And finishing up with the top weather story, smoky skies is the title. Even when we've had a lot of sunshine, the sky still appears hazy or milky a few times this last week. That's because of smoke from wildfires in Canada. In addition to causing a hazy sky during the day, the smoke also affects sunrise and sunset. Due to the way the smoke particles cause light to scatter in the atmosphere, those conditions have deepened shades of red and orange. The smoke particles can also negatively impact air quality. Today's air quality forecast puts Iowa in the moderate category, which won't affect most people. However, extremely sensitive folks could be impacted. Hazy skies are forecast to continue through Thursday before clearing out on Friday. And we're looking for a high today, 3, well above our normal high of 74. The low is expected to be 57, a tad higher than the normal low of 52. We set a record of 90 degrees for a high in 1972, and a low of 31 in 1931. Our mostly sunny skies continue through the foreseeable future. Sunset tonight is at 8:28 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 5:39 a.m., giving us 14 hours and 49 minutes of daylight. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, May 23, 2023. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading online on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day.